From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In wars around the world, children have not only become victims of violence, they've become perpetrators. Children are combatants in over three-fourths of the armed conflicts around the world. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with P.W. Singer of the Brookings Institution about his new book, Children at War. It describes how children are abducted, recruited, indoctrinated, and trained, and describes the consequences for militaries like our own that now face 12-year-olds with automatic weapons. Also, we talk with filmmaker Jean-Pierre Jeunet. He wrote and directed Amelie. His new film, A Very Long Engagement, is about two kinds of engagements, love and war. It's set during and just after World War I. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The so-called laws of war have been breaking down. Civilians are often targeted, and that includes children. But children are not just the victims of war. They now are the perpetrators of war atrocities. Children are combatants in over three-fourths of the armed conflicts around the world. My guest, P.W. Singer, examines this disturbing trend in his new book, Children at War. He not only describes how children are recruited, abducted, and indoctrinated, he considers the implications for armies like our own, which have to figure out appropriate rules of engagement when the enemy is 12 years old. P.W. Singer is a National Security Fellow at the Brookings Institution and directs its project on U.S. policy toward the Islamic world. His previous book, Corporate Warriors, is about the rise of the privatized military industry. Let's start with the scope of the problem. What are some of the countries that child soldiers are used in, and what are some of the wars they've played a part in?
Well, the practice of child soldiers is far more widespread than I think most people realize. Around the globe today, children under the age of 18 are fighting as soldiers in more than 75% of the world's conflicts. So pretty much any conflict that we've heard about, from Afghanistan to Iraq to some of the lesser known ones in places like Uganda, see child soldiers in them. Another way to think about it is in quantitative terms. There's more than 300,000 child soldiers out there right now. Another 500,000 children are serving in armed forces that aren't at war.
Why would you, if you're a militia or a terrorist group or an army, why would you want to use child soldiers? I mean, they're not that strong yet because their bodies aren't fully developed. They're not that smart and aware because their minds aren't fully developed. And children can be very, like, rebellious and difficult to control. What's the advantage of using them?
That's the problem with this practice so far, is that actually the warlord leaders out there have really only seen the advantage side of it. While children may not be as physically strong, changes in weapons technology right now mean that for those weapons that are most likely to be used out there, light weapons, the AK-47s of the world, as opposed to when we think of war, we often think of the most sophisticated weapons like jet fighters. But really, in most conflicts, it's the light weapons that are used. Children can be trained rather quickly to use them effectively. They may not reach the level of, say, a well-trained U.S. Army soldier, but with an AK-47, it's found that a 10-year-old can learn how to use it within 30 minutes. And the result is that this 10-year-old, with the new firepower and technology of these weapons, the new lethality of them, it means that 10-year-old can spray just as many bullets as, say, a Civil War regiment could in the same amount of time. Now, the organization leaders pull in these kids because they see them as useful. They pull them in because in some situations it may be that they don't have access to another labor pool. It may be because they have a cause that's not popular and they couldn't convince adults to join. And that's why you see a rise of a lot of these wars without ideology. For example, you know, conflicts in West Africa were more about controlling the diamond trade than any kind of politics side of it. And Colombia, it's the drug trade. So that's one way of doing it. Also, you don't have to pay kids typically. That's the reason that the FARC rebels in Colombia used them. They were facing, in a sense, a recruiting war with their adversaries. Their adversaries on the paramilitary side were willing to pay anyone $350 to join, $350 a month, whereas the FARC couldn't afford that, so they pulled in kids who were free. Kids are also more malleable than adults. They can be convinced to take on ideologies, fight with a fervor. In some cases, they indoctrinate them not just with politics, but they also maybe religious fundamentalism. In a lot of cases, they infuse them with narcotics or other things to make them more fierce than adult soldiers might be. They're willing to take risks that adult soldiers wouldn't be willing to take. So there's all sorts of reasons. And the troubling part of this is that so far these leaders haven't seen the downside of it. They've only seen the advantages of it. And probably the best case example of that was Charles Taylor. He was a self-styled warlord in Liberia. And he was a guy who was an escaped convict from Plymouth Jail in Massachusetts, went back home to Liberia. he invaded the country. He crossed the border with only 150 adult followers. His invasion was barely noticed. It was back in 1989. No one even really knew what was going on. But slowly, he built up his force by abducting and tricking children to join it. And within a couple of years, he had a force that numbered in the 10,000s. And that force controlled what came to be known as Taylorland, which was this warlord domain which did about $300 million worth of trade. A couple years later, he became president of Liberia. He won the civil war and became president of Liberia. So through kids, he was basically able to gain a kingdom.
We say that, you know, militia leaders haven't seen the downside yet of using children as soldiers. What's the downside that we're going to see more of?
Well, that's the challenge for us. The downside in terms of what it means for society, what it means for security, is pretty evident. It leads to more wars. Wars are easier to start because you can pull in a larger force, because these fringe leaders that wouldn't otherwise be able to get recruits can convince them to join. A great example there is Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army, which is this group based in northern Uganda. Effectively, Kony thinks that he is the embodiment of the Christian Holy Spirit. And he's convinced about 200 adult followers that this is the case. He's been able to build up a force of more than 10,000 soldiers using child soldiers and fight a civil war for over 10 years. It's left over half a million people as refugees and killed tens of thousands more. So this is a guy who would be the equivalent of a David Koresh-like figure inside the U.S., but through child soldiers has been able to cause a civil war and fight rather effectively in that civil war. So it leads to more wars, wars that don't have the ideology. It leads to wars that are more tragic, not only in terms of children being involved, but also in terms of the atrocities that are committed in them, the human rights violations, violations of the rules of war, etc. And then finally, it means that wars are harder to stop, because just when you beat a force, just when you wheedle it down, if only a couple adult leaders escape, they can then reconstitute their force rather quickly by pulling back in more children. And so these groups that would otherwise die out are able to linger on. We saw that in Sierra Leone, for example, and we might be seeing that going on in Afghanistan right now.
One of the things that makes it possible for people to recruit or abduct children and make them soldiers is the fact that there are so many orphans around the world. There's so many people who have been orphaned by famine, by AIDS, by war. So how do the recruiters take advantage of the many orphans around the world?
That's one of the real tragedies here, is that despite the fact that we're living in probably one of the most prosperous eras in human history, at the same time we're leaving several groups behind. And that's not only in terms of the problems of globalization writ large, but also there are special at-risk groups, such as orphans, such as refugees. And within these groups, children are a major part. They're especially vulnerable for abduction raids because they're disconnected from society. They're disconnected from their families. The Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda is a group that basically has built up its force by abducting children from orphanages. But also, they're more apt to be pulled in by recruiting techniques that effectively tell children that this is their only opportunity to protect themselves, the only place that they can get a safe environment, have a gun in their hand as opposed to the chaos around them. It's a place where they can get a square meal. It's a place where they can be a member of something rather than on their own. All sorts of ways to trick them.
I guess
that
they have very little to lose.
That's one of the other parts, is that they feed in to children's gullibility, so to speak, and tell them this is the way not only that you can become a man, avenge what's happened to you, take a part in society rather than being on your own, but also in some cases saying, look, you've got nothing else to lose. And that's particularly terrorist groups have used this as a means, saying your life now is so horrible, think how wonderful it will be in the afterlife if you undertake these operations.
If you're just joining us, my guest is P.W. Singer. He's a fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he's the author of the new book, Children at War, which is a book about child soldiers around the world. One of the many upsetting things about this, I mean, there is an ethic in I think most cultures, that you protect children, and that, you know, adults are often willing to risk harm to their own bodies to protect children. But I'm wondering if you think that children are used as cheaper life than the adults. If the adults protect themselves by putting the children in the front lines and having children take the most risks. If the children are in fact considered even cheaper life than the adults in the militaries are.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely a problem. And there's really two things to say about that. The first is when we look at human history, when we look at the history of warfare itself, over the last four millennia, the rule held that children had no place in it. They had no place in it as targets. They had no place in it as participants. It simply was not allowable. Now, there were violations of that, but there wasn't this practice, this global practice that we see going on right now, where you're seeing children targeted. More than 500 children have died every single day over the last decade in warfare. And at the same time, they're acting within war. More than 300,000 children are serving as soldiers. So we're seeing that rule change, and part of it is because we're looking at children differently in the context of war. That's the reality right now. That's the dark reality. And within that, certain groups do use children because they view them as cheaper, easier recruits. They see them as a way to spare the lives of their considered more valuable adult soldiers. And you can see the way they deploy children on the field, and everything from human wave attacks to there are certain groups that use children as live landmine detectors. Basically, they send kids down the trail first, and that's the way they find out if there's a mine there. To in other situations, they put children out at the checkpoints while adult leaders hide in the bush. And it's something that when we're facing these forces, we have to be aware of. This is the new nature of 21st century conflict, that there are children involved. And so we've got to shift our reaction to it.
Let's talk a little bit about how children are transformed into soldiers and what the indoctrination and initiation process is like. First of all, what are some of the things they're put through so that they learn how to kill and that they feel comfortable taking another life?
Well, they never feel, I don't think, comfortable. It's just part of a broader change in identity that these groups try and enact. And what's interesting and disturbing is they often have their parallels to the way we indoctrinate people into different organizations like armies or gangs, even fraternities, those sorts of things. And the most disturbing aspect of it, which happens, is when they force the child to kill very early on. It's meant as a breaking point. And you see these most often in abduction raids. And for example, I met a young child soldier from Sierra Leone. And basically the rebels showed up at their village, lined everyone up, shot some people, and then forced the kids to take part in the killing of another, of one of their neighbors there. And they held them at gunpoint and said, "You kill this person or we'll kill you." And the first kid that balked at it, they shot him. And every other kid then said, "You know what, that's what I've got to do." And these kids then described it as the turning point when they crossed into another identity. Once they'd done that, not only were they anathema to their home village, they felt they couldn't go back again, that everyone knew that they had killed and killed someone within that village, but also that this organization was made up of people like them. And so even though they didn't believe in it, they felt they had nowhere else to go. Other groups will use techniques like shaving the heads of kids, all the kids who immediately join. And it's a way of, much like we see with boot camp, it's a way of creating a new identity and also making it harder for those people to return. They stand out in regular society. Branding is something that happened. For example, also in Sierra Leone, the RUF there did this, where it would basically brand the letters RUF, which stood for the organization, the Revolutionary United Front, and they would put it on foreheads, shoulders, etc. And so these kids would stand out, and they would say, "Look, this is a group that's hated back home. That's why you can't go again. You're part of us."
My guest is P.W. Singer. His new book is called Children at War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is P.W. Singer. He's a fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he's the author of the new book, Children at War, which is about child soldiers around the world. You know, I've talked to many reporters over the years who've covered civil wars and regional wars, and I've heard often about encountering children with automatic weapons who are high. So you're not only dealing with facing a child opponent, but also like they're addled by virtue of being high on whatever the local drug of choice is. Is that something that you think is part of the process of getting them to do the job?
It's definitely something that these groups use. It's seen really as a tool to complete the training and indoctrination. And the drugs that they use can be anything from heroin to cocaine to there's different mixes that you'll see. Some it's even a mix of cocaine and gunpowder that's packed together. And what happens is usually the kid is forced in the first part to use the drugs, put at gunpoint or even held down, and a slit is made on the arm and it's packed in. But then very quickly addiction sets in. And there's two things here that take place. The first is when they're on the drugs, the kids, the sense of reality is changed. And so it all becomes almost, they've described it as being disconnected. It was as if someone else was out there fighting. And so the things that they were doing, it wasn't them, and the risks that they were facing, they weren't really seeing them. And then the second part is it's another way of creating dependency on that child soldier force, because now it's a physical dependency. If they leave, then they're in effect breaking that line of addiction. And so it's another way, it's another tool that these groups use. And then the legacy effect of that is obviously really terrible, because even when the war ends, you have this mass of adult kids that not just are scarred by the experience of being child soldiers, but also in many cases have drug addictions.
Let's talk a little bit about how we got to this point. You know, society's always had prohibitions against children fighting, and that was good not only for the children, but for the culture as a whole. You say that the first modern use of child soldiers was in the 1980s during the Iran-Iraq War. What did Iran do to break this taboo and start recruiting children or encouraging children to join the military?
At the time, Iran was fighting a losing war against Iraq, and it faced a disadvantage in terms of technology, and so it responded by trying to amp up its quantity versus the quality side. And even though it was a supposed Islamic republic that was guided by Sharia law, it actually violated that law and declared, and at the time it was Ayatollah Khomeini, declared that anyone as young as 12 could join. And then they set up a rather sophisticated recruiting program to pull in young boys as young as 12. And they would recruit in the schools and the like. And one of the things that they did was promise that anyone that did join and died in the battle would have an immediate entrance into heaven. And actually, they would give the kids who joined not just a weapon and a couple grenades, but also a key to wear around their neck, because it was the key that would unlock your way to heaven. And they used these kids in a way that was pretty much seen as cannon fodder. They were to advance first and break up the minefields, serve as extra targets, etc. And it was expected that most of them would die. And so the losses were rather high. Then one of the worst parts of it, which indicates that really they did intend for them to die, is that a small percentage were captured, around 1,000. And so at the end of that war, the Red Cross said, okay, do you want these prisoners back? Do you want these former child soldiers back? And Ayatollah Khomeini commented on it that these captured children, these are not our children. Basically, that our children were the ones who died, the ones who were captured. We want nothing of them.
So what happened to those children?
Many of them ended up being refugees and sent around the world to finding asylum across Europe and the like.
Okay, so Iran played a big part in this trend of child soldiers. Iraq played a part, too. What did Saddam Hussein do to mobilize child soldiers?
After the Gulf War, the regime faced a real problem, a crisis of legitimacy and a crisis of forces. And one of the ways it answered that was creating a whole system designed to build up child soldier forces as a way to pulling them in the regular forces. There were summer training camps where basically kids would spend up to 3 weeks getting political indoctrination, but also learning how to use an AK-47 and the like. The real backbone of it was a special unit that was created called the Ashbal Saddam, Saddam's Lion Cubs. And it was for boys between the ages of 10 to 15. And it was almost like you could think of it in terms of an equivalent of the Boy Scouts, except aside from, you know, the regular type of community, they would also learn how to use weapons, they would get political indoctrination and the like. And it was intended as a feeder organization into what was the Saddam Fedayeen. This is this paramilitary force that was led by Saddam's son Uday, that during our recent invasion, it was the Saddam Fedayeen which was the one that actually fought back as opposed to the Iraqi army. So they set up this whole system designed to train and indoctrinate children.
You know, your previous book was about private military corporations. So, you know, your previous book was about mercenaries and corporations that are now involved with war. And the new book is about children who fight in wars. And so reading these books back to back, it just feels like everybody's getting into the act. Everybody's at war.
Well, I think one of the ways to think about it and what motivates me is that I think we've got it wrong when we think about war. When we think about war, when we say the word war, the image in our heads is of men in uniform fighting for the political cause of their nation state. And the reality of warfare in the 21st century is it's not like that. It's men, it's women, it's children, and they're fighting in organizations that range from armies, rarely now, to warlord groups, drug cartels, terrorist groups, you name it. And the causes they're fighting for are rarely political in nature. They include economic causes like these corporations and the like, but also like these warlord economies that are really about, you know, drug trade, diamond trade, you name it. It may be religious causes, social causes. It may even be for no cause at all. Some of these, the child soldiers are in it because they've got no other choice. And so warfare is messier, and a lot of people would describe it as sort of postmodern. And that's what we have to own up to, is until we understand the way it really is, we can't respond to it properly.
P.W. Singer is the author of Children at War. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from The Dial Press, publisher of Marry After All, a debut novel about a New Jersey housewife's struggle to find herself, by Bill Gordon. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, child soldiers in Iraq that the American military is facing. We continue our conversation with P.W. Singer, author of the new book, Children at War. Also, we talk with Jean-Pierre Jeunet. He wrote and directed Amelie. His new film, A Very Long Engagement, is set during World War I. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with P.W. Singer. He's a fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of the new book, Children at War. Children are now combatants in about 75% of the conflicts around the world. Singer writes about how they are abducted, recruited, indoctrinated, and trained, and what the implications are for armies like our own, which face child soldiers. Are U.S. troops facing child soldiers in Iraq now?
Yes, and far more extensively than anyone's been willing to talk about. As the insurgency grew, child soldiers were seen as a pull for it, and are seen as a pull for it, and pulled into it. And perhaps the best indicator was the fact that the same week that President Bush made his mission accomplished speech in the aircraft carrier landing, that same week, an Iraqi 12-year-old shot up a U.S. Marine force in the city of Mosul. And since then, the use has grown and grown and grown. And they range from child sniper incidents to an Iraqi 15-year-old that tossed a grenade into a U.S. Army truck and blew off the leg of an American trooper. What's worrisome is that the broad insurgent forces that we're facing, each one of them has started to use child soldiers. The former Ba'athist forces, the old Saddam loyalists, they're trying to tap into this old network of Ashbal Saddam groups. It's also taking place in the Sunni triangle, including, for example, the fighting in Fallujah last November. Saw U.S. Marines fighting what they described as children with assault rifles. And then also even in the Shia sector, for example, Muqtadar Sadr is this radical religious cleric there who led an uprising against us, and the fighting was particularly fierce in the city of Najaf. He openly talked about how great it was that they had child soldiers. And in the book, there's some pretty disturbing quotes from some 14-year-olds and some 12-year-olds about their experience of fighting U.S. forces.
The questions this poses for U.S. troops, I guess, is also being faced by other armies around the world. I mean, American troops want to think of themselves as being where they are to help children, among other things, and to protect children. You know, our favorite images are of GIs, you know, in World War II giving out chewing gum and stuff to children. And now they're in a position where they don't know whether the children are going to shoot them or not. And so what kind of instructions do American soldiers have about whether to shoot children who seem to be soldiers?
It's perhaps one of the toughest dilemmas of this doctrine, the fact that soldiers face very real threats from a foe that they would rather not do harm to. Simply put, a bullet from a 40-year-old kills just like a bullet from a 14-year-old. At the same time, though, you're facing a child, and no soldier wants to be put into that situation. The worst part of it, and this is one of the things that the book is arguing, is that U.S. forces right now don't have this type of intelligence preparation, training, doctrine, equipment, etc., to give them that kind of support. And I'll give you a pretty pointed example. Last year, U.S. forces were ready to deploy into Liberia, which had a civil war that was going on there. And there was a Marine unit that had 2,400 Marines in it, and they were right offshore. They were about to go into an area that had 60% child soldiers. And I ended up getting an email from one of the officers in the unit, and he said, look, we've been reading on the news reports that this area we're about to go into has 60% of child soldiers there. We've gotten no preparation, nothing about it. Can you help us out? And so I ended up sending them, I emailed the draft of the book to them. That's not the way it's supposed to be. That's just simply not the way it's supposed to be. And so just as our forces have had to change to and their training for 21st century warfare, dealing with more urban environments, the fact that we're not facing armies that use tanks anymore, but they're insurgents. Another part of this is the fact that the adversaries out there are very likely to be children. In fact, it's almost inevitable that they will be children. And they have been children, and we've got to own up to it.
So once you sent the advanced copy of your book, do you think it accomplished anything? Was it helpful? Did you hear back from this person?
I hope so. Yeah, I mean, they were thankful for it. And actually, the Marines have been one of the more progressive organizations looking at this issue. For example, they held a conference at Quantico on the child soldiers issue, and the speakers at it included myself, a former British military officer who'd faced child soldiers in West Africa, to a former child soldier himself. And so the Marines looked at it and said, look, this is one of the ways that warfare is changing, and we need to catch up to it. Unfortunately, it hasn't been integrated into the broader training doctrine, the war gaming, et cetera, the equipment, you name it. It was really just a small conference that was held. Gee whiz, isn't this interesting?
We say the United States doesn't really have a policy yet. They haven't thought through how to handle child soldiers. Are there any countries who have?
not holistically. There's different countries that have built up different experiences and deal with different aspects of it quite well. For example, some countries have very good programs in terms of how they do rehabilitation. You see that in the Philippines or in Colombia. In other countries, the type of support that they give to their troops afterwards are quite good. We also should be willing to learn from the mistakes that others make. And one of the things that's worrisome is that we haven't been willing to do that. Not only do we not look at the experiences that our allies have had, for example, the experiences that the British Army had in its operations in West Africa, a lot of them that didn't go quite well with child soldiers. There was one that the book talks about where a British Army force was taken hostage by a child soldier force, and they had to launch a rescue raid, and all sorts of things happened from that. There's other armies that we don't typically work with that have a huge experience. For example, the Sri Lankan army has been fighting the civil war for almost 2 decades and have built up a wealth of experience. So it's one of those things that we should be willing to learn. But really, at the end of the day, it's about facing up to the way war is rather than the way we wish it was.
You know, just one more really frightening thing about the tens of thousands of children who are fighting in these wars now. If all they've known is violence, and if they have been fighting from the age of 10 or 11, then how do they get to the point? How are they given the opportunity to develop any empathy or, you know, feelings with other people? And is it possible to learn that after years of having killed people? I mean, can you ever become, you know, fully human and social again? Or are we going to be surrounded in the world by the grown-up version of the child soldiers who never learned the meaning of empathy?
It's one of the abuses of this practice that normally doesn't get talked about, and really it's the destruction of childhood itself. And the worry about that is that this is a period in our lives where your identity is shaped and your whole sense of right and wrong is shaped. And so that's one of the worst abuses of this. So the challenge of these children after the conflict is that they face huge issues in reintegrating. That can be everything from finding their families to the psychological scarring, the physical scarring and ailments that have been dealt to them, to basically lack of vocational opportunities, you name it. And so the programs that help them, they're everything from these camps that basically offer them, you know, just a safe place to get away from it all, to there's some very great programs that do things like help them catch up in their schooling, to programs that help the local society reintegrate. For example, there's a radio station in Sierra Leone that's not only designed for kids to listen to, but also is run by former child soldiers themselves. So there's a lot of these programs out there. The problem is they're almost all under-resourced, and they're not as widespread as they should be.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me to talk about this important issue.
P.W. Singer is the author of Children at War. Coming up, the director of the film Amelie talks about his new movie, A Very Long Engagement, which is set during World War I. This is Fresh Air. The writer and director of the films Amelie, Delicatessen, and City of Lost Children, Jean-Pierre Jeunet, has a new film called A Very Long Engagement. It's about two engagements, one of love, the other of war. A young woman, played by Audrey Tautou, the star of Amelie, is separated from her fiancé when he's called to fight in World War I. Driven mad by the gore and insanity of trench warfare, he intentionally gets himself wounded so that he can be sent home to his lover. But he and four other soldiers accused of trying to get sent home are court-martialed for self-mutilation. Their punishment is to be exiled to no man's land, the space between the French and German front lines, where they will either be shot by the Germans or starve and freeze to death. The movie alternates between the story of the soldiers and the young soldier's fiancé. When the war is over and the young soldier doesn't return home, she obsessively tries to reconstruct what happened to him. The film is based on the novel of the same name. Filmmaker Jean-Pierre Jeunet grew up near the battlefield of Verdun and read everything he could about World War I to the point of giving himself nightmares. He created two different visual styles for the film, one for trench warfare, the other for pre- and post-war life in the French countryside. I really love the way the World War I scenes are shot, and the scenes almost look like they're based on photographs of the period. Can you describe a little bit the look that you wanted to get and the lighting that you used to get that look? And I should say here that it's not exactly shot in black and white, but it's almost closer to black and white than it is to color.
Yes. The First World War is very graphic. I try to avoid too much aestheticism for the war, but about the war, I tried, it's not a question of style, but I tried to avoid imagination. I used only references. For example, the film opens with a shot with a broken Christ, and it's exactly a rip-off of a real picture, a real photograph, you know. And you can see later a dead horse on a tree, and it's also a real picture from a real picture. But for the rest of the film, of course, I brought my own imagination. And we asked themselves with my director of photography, Bruno Delbonnel, and we understood something. We are so used to watch the picture from the First World War in black and white or in sepia. We decided to get something a little bit like this. And of course, the sepia and the brown tone, the brown color, it's pretty warm. And for the war, we try to get something colder. And we try to avoid the blue color because it's you know, you see every war film in blue color. And we got something between green and yellow. And the mud is pretty yellow. And you can feel how it's wet and disgusting. And for the rest of the film, the romantic part, we used the sepia tone. And exactly like in Godfather No. 2, it was our reference. And we, for this film, we had the chance, we had the luck to use a digital process. They couldn't use it. It was 20 years ago, of course. For example, on the Mathilde's bedroom, you can see only the bed is a little bit purple and the rest of the frame is brown, you know. And for that, we make just a mask on the bed and you can fix the color just about the bed. It's very useful.
I went to see the movie without having read anything about it beforehand. And in one scene, I was thinking, that really looks like Jodie Foster. And then I was thinking, that's got to be Jodie Foster. And of course, she's speaking French in the movie. And my suspicion was confirmed at the end of the movie in the credits. But it doesn't seem to be something that's been particularly advertised. And I was wondering if that was intentional or not.
Yes. I could say, in fact, it's a fake Jodie Foster, but she's in CGI and we are very good in France to make CGI shots. But, you know, I do all the time the same joke, so I won't do this joke for you. Jodie Foster is completely fluent, you have to know that, and she has absolutely no accent at all. And she was in Paris to, I think it was for Panic Room, to make the dubbing, because she dubbed herself for the French version. And she called me to have a meeting. And my wife is American, and she was very surprised because she has the same age. She was a big star when she was a kid. And we had a meeting at the Café Les Deux Moulins, the cafe of Amélie. And so Jodie Foster explained to me she would like to act in French. And of course, it was too late for this film because I hired Audrey Tautou. And I remember I sent her later the script and on email with three propositions. The first one, get lost. The second one, it was, I accept to be a guest star for your film. And the third one was, I would prefer to act a bigger role. And she chose the third one. And I was very lucky because she is very easy and she is not a star. She was very a good example for everybody in France. She wasn't late. She was so simple, you know. It was a great pleasure. And about the advertising, she refused on her contract to be on the poster, on the trailer, because she knew by heart the studio, I suppose, and you can imagine Jodie Foster in a very long engagement, this kind of stuff. And I think it's fair play.
I think she's really terrific in the movie. The movie, of course, stars Audrey Tautou, who also starred in your film, Amelie. I'm wondering, as a director, what you find so special about working with her.
She, for me, she is the perfect actress because, for example, she is in first very technical and very. She has a great sense of timing. Now we know she is able to make everything. For example, with Amelie, it was light and easy, and it was more comedy, and she was perfect. And now on this film, she's always on the razor edge. She almost cries, and she doesn't cry. It was the role of the game. We decided together. And it wasn't easy for her, you know. And now we know she is able to do that, too. And just for the shooting, it was a little bit more difficult than Amelie, because for Amelie, it was just a pleasure for everybody. She made some jokes on the set every day. For this film, she was more concentrated. She was more quiet, and she needed some silence. And I remember the first week, I was afraid. I thought, oh, maybe she's not happy. Maybe she regrets to accept this film. And we had an explanation, and she cried, and she explained to me, it's a pressure. It's very difficult for me. I can't be the same Audrey than Amelie. I need to be inside myself, you know. And I said, okay. And I explained to the other people, and it was a different game. But she's perfect for me. And in fact, I don't know her very well. We are not very close on the real life. I don't have any dinner every day, you know. But because maybe we are very similar, we have the same spirit, the same humor, the same humility.
Mm-hmm.
We are very similar.
You know, one of the things that bothers me in the casting of a lot of movies is this. A lot of movies that are set in the past, all the actors seem like contemporary fashion models wearing clothing of the past. In your movie, and particularly like in the World War One scenes, the actors' faces somehow look right for the period.
Yes, exactly.
And if you could talk a little bit about finding the right faces for a movie set during World War One.
Yeah. I think in first we had so many references. I think we made a casting with something like 2,000 people, and I chose 300 people. But I saw the picture of each of them, you know. And, you know, it was very simple. You are from the beginning of the century, or you're not. And sometimes I made a casting for the supporting roles or supporting character. And I said, no, I'm sorry, but you are not from the beginning of the century. It was very simple. And sometimes with a moustache, it was much better, but sometimes not, you know. And on the trench, I'm very happy because we made a casting in country. It wasn't in Paris. It was in the middle of France. And the faces are very different because people are coming from the farm. They are worker. And it's very different. On the scene for the balloon, it was made in Paris. And the faces are less interesting.
My guest is Jean-Pierre Jeunet. His new film is called A Very Long Engagement. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jean-Pierre Jeunet. He wrote and directed the film Amélie. His new film, A Very Long Engagement, stars Audrey Tautou, the star of Amélie. It's set in France during and just after World War I. What are some of the movies that you grew up with that made the biggest impression on you as a filmmaker?
You know, I suppose every director have to, big references, a very important film. And for me, it was two features I discovered when I was a teenager. The first one was Once Upon a Time in the West from Sergio Leone, spaghetti western. I saw it when I was 17, and I couldn't speak during 3 days. I remember my parents were very worried and they were afraid because they asked me, "Are you sick? What's the problem?" And I said, "You can't understand. You can't understand." You know, it was so important for me. And the second one was A Clockwork Orange from Stanley Kubrick, and because the aesthetism, because the pleasure to play with the music, with the picture, with the, you know, just the pleasure to make a film, and I maybe that's the reason I love so much to use short lens and to play with all the toys of the cinema, the costumes, the production design, and Orson Welles has a big influence later on me. But I understood something. In fact, I started to make movies before to watch movies. And I think it's pretty rare. I think I started to make a kind of movies at 9. I had a ViewMaster. It was a toy where you put some 3D picture inside. And I had a projector too. And I invented new dialogues with my friend. And we made some kind of movies. And I was very young. And that's my philosophy of cinema. Just buy a camera or find a camera, because with the video camera now, it's much easier, you know, and make movies.
You referred to using a short lens. What is a short lens?
A short lens, it's the opposite of a long lens. A short lens is a wide angle. And with a short lens, you can see everything behind the character.
Right.
And in general, everything is in focus. And it means you have to pay attention to every detail, because behind the character, you can see the walls, the paper on the walls. You can see every detail, you know. And it's not like in a TV movie. It's very different. And of course, if you are very close to the character, to the face of the actor, you get something very expressive, because it's the short lens has the tendency to transformate a little bit the faces. And you have to pay attention to that, because especially with a woman, if you are too close or if the lens is too short, you get something very ugly. And it's very difficult to use it, but much more interesting. And Stanley Kubrick, Orson Welles, Sergio Leone used, and Terry Gilliam too, for example, they use a short lens. And I try to use only short lens, the 20 millimeters, 25 and 27, and that's it. And of course, we lose a lot of time, because you have to pay attention to everything behind the actors.
I want to ask you about something that happens several times in A Very Long Engagement. The character who's played by Audrey Tautou has all these, I don't know, superstitions or compulsive thoughts. I don't know exactly how to describe them. But she says, for example, you know, if the dog comes in before I count to 10, that means my fiancé will survive the war. If I get to this intersection before his car does, that means that he will survive the war. She's always doing that. Was that written in the novel that you based the movie on, or is that something that you added?
No, it wasn't on the novel. That's exactly the kind of detail we put with my screenwriter, the kind of detail we love. It's exactly the same spirit than in Amélie. We tried to avoid too much detail like in Amélie, but not completely. And I love this part, because I made the same thing when I was younger. And I saw a film one day. It was a French film, very, very, very French. The author spoke about himself, you know, and he was a director. So he spoke about his own story. And he peed on the toilet, and he said if I don't put any drop on the side of the toilet, I will have the help from the government to make my next movie. And I loved this story. Maybe it's a kind of homage to the French cinema, the French non-realist cinema.
And just one more question. I understand you started your career making TV commercials?
No. I started with short film, animation short film, because I worked, you know, I was a worker when I was 17. And it was easier for me to make animation short film than live action short film. And after the animation, I met Marc Caro, my partner I worked with. And we made some live action short film. One of them, the French title was Le Bunker de la Dernière Rafale, the bunker of the last shot, something like this. It was in a theater in Paris during 6 years with Eraserhead, the first David Lynch movies. And it was a kind of cult show during 6 years. And we wrote during this time, we wrote two or three features, but it was very difficult to find the money because it was so different, so special. Nobody wanted to give money for this film. And we were waiting for 10 years to get the money to make Delicatessen.
I see.
And during this time to leave, of course, I made in first video music video, and after a while, a commercial. And it was the best way because I met my producer making a video, a commercial. And she was Claudie Ossard, and at the end, she produced Delicatessen.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jean-Pierre Jeunet directed the new film A Very Long Engagement. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of astrologer Susan Miller's The Year Ahead 2005, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From Harcourt, publisher of The Facts Behind the Helsinki Rockamadios, a collection of short stories by Jan Martell, author of The Life of Pi. And from BBC America and the comedy Kumar's at Number 42, part improv, part talk show. Tom Jones guest stars tonight at 10 on BBC America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Now that several major airlines are in bankruptcy, prices, routes, and many other things are shifting. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Scott McCartney. He covers the airline industry for the Wall Street Journal and writes the column The Middle Seat. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.